All right, good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you all again. I hope all those who spent Shabbos in Teaneck enjoyed very much. I always enjoy it. And the truth is I enjoy this forum as well, Ask the Rabbi, because I get to hear what's on your mind. And, of course, whatever I can't answer, I refer to Rav Pinny, which is the only fair thing to do. So one question came in from Shana. Do you want me to read it in?
Read it in.
Hashem is referred to in different ways and by different names in the Torah. I've heard these names relate to his attributes or other characteristics. Can you go over his names, why he's referred to by those names at those times, what the names mean, and how they're associated with his attributes? That's what we call a little compound question. All right? There are many parts to that question. So I brought in the Rambam, Maimonides, on Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the laws of the fundamentals of Torah. Drew the first work in his Yad HaZaka's magnum opus of Halacha, because the classic seven names of God that we use are names that we're not allowed to erase. Okay, so that's the context in which he mentions them here. And the names are, of course, the ineffable name of God, Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei. We don't even spell it out, much less enunciate it. Then Kael, all right, which is Aleph Lamed, and extensions of that name, Eloka, Elokim. The two famous ones are Hashem, that we pronounce Ado and then Noi. That and Elokim are the most common to us. Ekya, which you find in the beginning of the book of Exodus, Shmos.
What was it?
Ekya. Aleph Hey Yud Hey. God says, I will be, or I am that I am, or I will be that I will be, right? So that Aleph Hey Yud Hey is also considered a name of God when it's used in that context. Shakai Shin Dalad Yud and Swakos, alright? Now notice in all of them, we treat God's names with such reverence and humility that we never pronounce it except in the context of davening. So we announce it, for whatever reason, it's always a K or a Kuf sound that's added to it. All right, so what do the names mean? So the classic name of God is... Yes?
Can you interrupt?
What about
the Yod name?
Right, so that's actually not a name. What that is a printer's abbreviation. So as not to have to print God's name in Sidurim, for example. So you find many Sidurim, they'll use the Yud-Yud. And it's just a reference to the fact that the ineffable name of God begins with a Yud. So it's not really considered a holy name. It's just a ref, doesn't mean anything. Yes?
I think I know the answer to this. But
good.
In English, we say God.
Right.
But that's not a word we need to be worried about. Just
well, it's not entirely true, because...
You have to write G...
Oh, so if you want, ask the question after that, because I have Rav Avinash's commentary. He goes into that. There are different the different opinions. But let's understand first. So the classic name of God, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the ineffable name of God that we never pronounce, so that is a name that we don't even define, and it represents, to some extent, the unknowability of God's essence. All right, sounds very highfalutin, but we're human beings, we're trapped in material bodies, we have limited intellects. Even our references to the Creator have to be made in a way that reflects that type of humility on our part, that we can't fully know God. The name as it's spelled out with the Yud, K, Vav, K, so a number of ways to understand it. One, it's a reference to Hoya Hove Veyia, that God was, is, and will be. Meaning, what we know about God, we know so little, but what's obvious to us is that God is eternal, that God transcends time. And that's one aspect of that name. The other interesting part about that name is that's the name that's always used, or only used, in the context of God and the Jewish people. Okay? In other words, God will speak to us as Elohim also, which we'll get to in a moment, but he'll never speak or interact to the nations of the world with that name. That's a uniqueness of our relationship with God. The generic reference to the deity, if I could say such a thing, is Elohim, like Bereishis Bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. And Elohim, see, the ineffable name of God does not reflect an attribute as much as it is just a reference to God's identity or existence. I like hearing myself. That's good. Sure. All right, we're back in business. Oh, I can even look at myself. Not just hear myself talk.
There you go, even better.
So Elohim is really how we refer to the God of nature, the God who is the creator, the God who is the master of everything. So that's the name by which God relates to all of mankind and all his creatures. And that's why the story of creation, the Torah itself, begins with the name Elohim. And it's a name that you find exclusively used during the days, the accounts of creation. Then you have other names, the diminutives of that name, Kel and Eloka, are really similar in the sense. Elohim means the God's the master of all powers, and Kel, even the word Aleph Lamed, by the way, El is a word that's used in other contexts also, just meaning a power. Michamocha Ba'elim Hashem, who is like you among the Elim? What's an El? An El is a power. So if we perceive God's works, all right, in a certain powerful context, that's the name Elohim that's used. Ekiah, which is the name that God used to introduce himself to Moshe and tell Moshe that, tell the people this is who I am. So that's really a God that spans all of eternity also. And that's again a unique relationship that he has with us. Shakai, Shin Dalet Yud. So that reminds us of a Hebrew word, Dai. Dai meaning sufficient, enough, correct. It's Misha Omar La'olamo Dai. God is the one who said to his world, enough. Meaning, as creation unfolded, at a certain point, we say over 6 days of creation, God said, Dai, and moved on to the next stage. And when Shabbos came, Dai to the world, to the creative process as well. And Tzvakos, the God of hosts, means the God of who's the master of everything, the universe, the angels, all the various beings that exist. Komar Hashem Elokei Tzvaos, God is the God of hosts, meaning in all of nature, in its manifold aspects, that is God is Tzvakos. I saw an interesting thing. I think I mentioned on Shabbos also. I don't know if it was this group or some other context. There was a great rabbi and teacher in Brooklyn named Avigdor Miller. And he died a number of years ago. It was late 90s, I think, when he died. And he was once asked, why does the Torah use so many anthropomorphisms? Did I mention on Shabbos?
No.
Why does the Torah use so many anthropomorphisms, meaning we relate to God in such human terms? God speaks, God's face, God's hands, etc. Because we know God is not physical at all. It's a fundamental principle of our faith. God has no goof, he has no physical dimensions, he has no emotions, and yet the Torah is replete with these references to God. Not only his hands, feet, face, but even that he gets angry. So he said, there is, of course, a danger in the anthropomorphisms that a person will make a grave mistake and think that God has a physical form, which would be idolatry. But he said the Torah could not speak to us just in abstract form, because there's a greater danger, and that is a person will not be able to relate to God at all. If we had to think of just an abstract entity without using the language of the Torah, that God spoke, God heard, etc., then God would be almost cold and distant, and mankind could not relate to him at all. So he says that's why the Torah uses those references, even though they're imprecise, because, of course, God doesn't have any of those physical characteristics. So how then do we relate to God? A name, of course. What's the Hebrew word for name? Shem. So we say Hashem means the name. What's a name? A shem. So Rav Hirsch says that a shem is similar to the Hebrew word sham, there. What does it mean? A name gives a person an identity. All right, that's you. That's who you are. That's how I can find you, relate to you. Imagine a world where none of us had names at all. All right? Something would have to happen. They give us numbers, or, you know, we have to find some way to identify each other. So a name is a means of identification. In this context, aside from Yudke Vavke, the ineffable name, see, each name represents attributes of God by which we see His might, we see His power, we see His control over the universe, and therefore we are able to deepen that relationship with Him. So the question was asked, what about in English? So you'll be interested in this, Rav Pini. This is Rav Aviner's commentary. So he quotes from the Nefesh HaRav, which is a book that was written by Rav Herschel Schechter on Rav Soloveitchik. And he says that Rav Soloveitchik's father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, when he would go to the restroom, he would take out all his bills and coins before going into the restroom.
Oh, yeah.
God we trust, correct.
Wow.
He felt it was irreverent. Now his son, Rav Yosef Dov, was not machmir like this, all right? He was not stringent. And he said that that doesn't have to be done. It was a stringency that his father adopted. Conversely, he said he ridiculed the notion of writing G-D in English, because he said that what we treat with holiness is however we refer to God. So if you read G-D God, then it's also God. So what are you gaining by it? He said if you made four asterisks and said that was God, that related to God, it would be just as holy. So he didn't do it. But on the other hand, someone that he deeply respected, Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski, said no, it's a good practice to do. He was the Dayan, the chief judge of Vilna in the years, the decades before the Holocaust. So he said, no, it's a good practice to do, to write the G-D. The truth is, I have always done it in my handwriting, but if I'm writing something formal, like a book or something, then I would spell it out. So that's the that's God. Of course, we can't really exhaust the area, but nonetheless, those are the basic ideas. Yes?
Is there any truth to the idea of 72 names of God?
No, you're referring to a God has a name of 72 letters and another name of 42 letters. 42 letters, yeah. And a name of 72 letters. 42 is Anah B'Koach, very good. The first letter of every word spells out that name. The name of 72 letters is a name that comes from three psukim that are taken from the Torah right before Kriyas Yamsuf. But the Rambam actually dismissed the notion that those names are holy and that they have any significance. But
it says
that's
it's not a 72. There is no 72-letter word. It's probably a sentence. A word.
It's actually all the words in those three psukim are combined into one long word.
In the Mori, because he says it's probably a sentence. He doesn't say what it is.
He doesn't accept the idea that there's any sanctity to it.
Right.
Others did. Yeah.
Are they in the portion of?
The bottom line is I don't know. I don't think anyone really knows what they mean anyway. There's also a 12-letter name. Right, for those who couldn't afford the 42 or 72 letter name. No, I'm kidding.
As in Birka HaKohen, though, like, I know in the siddurim that we use here in the gray box, when the Kohen is like chanting the melody, and there's a spot that you're supposed to be on your own, it says like glance over these letters, but don't try to pronounce them.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Right. The truth is, I haven't delete that whole phrase all entirely, because, right. In the prayer that we say about dreams during Birchat Kohanim, it's actually the last one, the Yiratzon. Ben Shimcha Gadol, your great, awesome name of 22 letters that emerges from the Psukim, and it quotes four words, okay? And
that's from the Kabbalists.
Yeah, that's Kabbalistic. What can I tell you? That's not my field.
Right. Mine neither.
Right. Yes.
I have a follow-up question.
Sure.
What is the word Eicha? How do you spell that, and what does that mean?
Eicha?
Yeah.
Like Aleph Yud Chaf Hey?
The one that you had mentioned in the list of names.
Ekye, Aleph Hey Yud Hey. Well, Ehaye means I will be. All right.
Okay.
Like you'll say, Ehaye Babayit Bocha, I'll be home in an hour. That type of thing. But in the Torah it says, Ekye Sher Ekye, I will be that I will be. And as Rashi explains there, it means you could tell them that I'm the God of eternity, that as I'm with them now, I'll be with them throughout their troubles in the future. All right? It's actually pretty awesome if you think about it that God said this to Moshe over 33 centuries ago, that he'll be with us then in Egypt and then throughout history, and here we are so many years later.
And,
Aleph Hey Yud Hey. Right. But if it's used in connection with God, so we wouldn't write it out that way. It's rare. I think that's the only context in the Torah that's used in connection with God. Otherwise, it's a general Hebrew word. Yeah. Yud and a hey. Correct.
Okay,
correct. Now, you have the provocative questions on Shabbos, I remember, right? No? Okay. No, all right. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I have two questions.
Ah, okay.
Okay. As you can see, my finger is getting a little swollen here, and I'm having trouble getting my ring off. Is this a minhag or a rabbinic to take your rings off when you wash? When you do the
How often do you take it off?
Sometimes I forget at night, so when I wake up in the morning, like today, I really struggled to try to get it off.
Right.
So do you have to take your rings
off? If you keep it on all the time, then you would not have to take it off.
I thought you always had to take your rings off when you washed.
Oh, if you keep it on all the time, you wouldn't have to. It's the laws of chatzitza and interspersion.
Okay.
But if you take it off at night, you take it off if...
kneading dough, let's say.
Kneading dough. I was thinking or plowing the field. That's correct.
This one, I don't sleep with it. I take this one off, but this is just getting harder and harder. And
right.
Like, and you can see, like...
It's irritated.
So I just wanted to make sure that I can...
Right. So again, if you take it off every night,
no, I do not.
Then you can't. But if you leave it on, but if it's tight, you may not want to leave it on overnight. That's a circulation issue. That's also beyond my ken.
Yeah, like tomorrow morning, it's going to be very hard to.
Right.
But this one.
That's easy to come off.
Yes, it's just this ring. Okay.
Right.
So I'm gonna leave it.
Either stretch the ring or shrink the finger. One of the two.
We're trying to figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you leave it on for a few days at a time, you can really wash with it.
Okay.
But if you take it off when you're doing, if it's going to get messy, one day
the time,
during the day, then you should
so if
take
with
it off.
So I sleep overnight, then I don't have to technically take it off in the morning.
Yeah, in theory.
Okay.
Right.
And then another question that came up. After seeing the news this week of that there was a shooting, and came up at dinner.
There's a shooting in America?
No way.
Yeah. And this came up. So,
what shooting are you talking about?
In Arizona.
Which one?
I don't know. I didn't really see the news.
Okay.
Like, I just kind of saw it very quickly and didn't look it up again. But this is my question: is if you're not a person of the law, right? So. Can you carry a gun on Shabbat? That was our question.
That's a great question.
That's a very good question.
And do the IDF, if they're off duty, like at home for, let's say, Shabbat, are they carrying their gun as well?
Right. So anyone in Israel is actually pretty common that in every shul there are people with guns. So a person will be allowed to carry. A gun is ordinarily...
Can we carry our...
Well, let's just talk about you first. leave me out of it. Right. We actually are dealing with this issue now of people who are licensed to carrying guns. The bottom line is a gun is muktzah.
Okay.
Because it has no proper Shabbos use.
Okay.
But if it's used for self-defense or the defense of others, then it's not muktzah anymore. So in Israel, for example, it's very common to see people with guns in shul,
mm-hmm.
people with guns on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell you, even on Shabbos, I remember my nephew just got out of the army a few months ago, and in your early... During basic training, they want you to always remain attached to your gun.
Oh, interesting.
You have to take it with you into the shower, into bed, wherever you are. The gun is attached to you, so that...
And it's loaded?
No, well, it could be a safety on it.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be loaded necessarily.
Wow.
But there's always rounds of ammunition nearby.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes it'll be loaded and just the safety is on. But they want you to remain attached to it at all times. So remember, we visited him once, and he brought the Shabbos table. He had it, and put it down next to his chair. You always have to have it. Always have to have it with you. That's part of the training. So in fact, it would be the same thing for self-defense purposes.
Okay.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But don't try it at home unless you're licensed. Yes.
So we know that we're supposed to rush to a mitzvah, correct? Does that include marriage?
Yeah, I guess it's all relative, though. You know, I got a complaint from someone talking about rushing to a mitzvah that... In the block around the shul, there are cars that drive recklessly early in the morning and late in the afternoon. They shouldn't be late for Shacharis or for Mincha. And even late at night, we have late Maariv Minyan, correct.
How many minyan do you have per day?
We have six for Shacharis.
Nice.
We have on a weekday,
wow.
Yeah. We have two.
You have one of the largest shuls in Bergen County.
We have two.
Wow.
We have two Mincha because it's.
Late.
Right, early and late. Actually, we have three for Mincha.
Wow.
And Maariv, we have, I guess, five or six. We have one before Zman, before the time, at the time, and then 9, 10, or 1, and the last one's 11 o'clock.
Wow.
Yeah. What was the question? Oh, recklessness. Yes, I'm saying people are rushing to shul. So that's you have to balance the haste in fulfilling a mitzvah with the potential damage you could do to other people or yourself in getting there. And I would say the same thing applies to marriage also.
Yes.
All right? You can't be too deliberate. You know, paralysis by analysis is also not good. You can't overthink. But on the other hand, you can't just, you know, meet someone and say, that's it. I'm getting married even before the check comes. Okay.
Which happens.
Right.
Is there a mitzvah to live in Israel?
There's a mitzvah to live in Israel.
So then why are so many Jews like, you know, who have the opportunity to live there, like living elsewhere?
You mean like us?
Yeah.
That's correct. I'm looking at the guy. This guy doesn't live in Israel. This guy right here. Yeah, it's a big problem. You should. It's a question that in the book of the Kuzari, the king of the Khazars asked the rabbi, the Chaver, that very question. If it's such a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel, how come so few Jews live there? He asked this question in the 1100s. All right? And the Rabbi Huda Halevi, who's the author of the book, puts the answer in the mouth of the Chaver, the rabbi, who says to the king of the Khazars, "You have exposed our shame." Right, that's the answer that he gives. We've exposed our shame. I think he says all the excuses people use are kitzifzuf hazarzir, like the chirping of a nightingale. That doesn't really amount to much. There's certain leniencies, you know. There are other circumstances. A person can't earn a living. A person can't find a spouse. Dangerous beyond, you know, beyond reason. Almost none of those reasons apply anymore today, and that's why even, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein said that it's a commandment, but it's not an obligatory commandment. You know, it's not something you have to do, like put on tefillin. It's something, though, that if you do it, you fulfill a mitzvah. All right? There are certain mitzvahs that are obligatory and others that you just fulfill the mitzvah, but it's not incumbent upon you to do. What's the classic case of the latter? A mitzvah kiyumit that you just fulfill, but you don't have to do it? Divorcing one's wife. All right? If you divorce your wife, you fulfill a mitzvah in the Torah by giving her a get, a divorce document. But no one's going to say you're obligated to do it. You fulfill a mitzvah when you do it, but you're not obligated to do it, obviously. So he analogized living in the land of Israel to that. So that's a common approach that many people not in Israel use based on that. There's a certain logic to it, but the many who disagree with that and say no, since you can only fulfill all the mitzvahs in the land of Israel, and God gave us the land of Israel and has now returned us to the land of Israel. So it's very hard to find a good answer for that these days.
Can you backtrack?
Yeah.
To what you just said about giving somebody a gift?
I'm sorry?
No, like not rushing to get a divorce.
No. there's a mitzvah in the Torah. One of the 613 mitzvahs is to give one's wife a get.
But you said you're not obligated to?
Of course not. You should stay married.
Oh, fine.
But if you're going to get divorced, it should be done in
correct.
This way.
That's yeah, correct. Okay. In other words, no person should say, I want to fulfill all of it in the Torah, therefore I'll divorce my wife. I love her, I'll divorce her. No, that we wouldn't say. So there are other mitzvahs like that also. You fulfill the mitzvah, but you don't have to, go affirmatively and try to fulfill it. But that's a classic one. Yes, sir?
What would you say are the, or if there are any, what are the major, points of contention or arguments right now, currently, in, the Orthodox Jewish world, or the religious disagreements, or...
We could be here for a few weeks.
What would you say is the most prominent right now?
Well, I run a very placid shop, so it's not going to come into Teaneck, but across the Orthodox, I guess if you pick up any newspaper today, any Jewish newspaper, you see the trends, what's on people's minds, what's getting people exercised. So I think a lot, women's issues, obviously, what a woman can and can't do within Orthodoxy. Conversion is a staple. It's been like that for at least a century. Who can convert and who should be able to convert them? Those are the two. I think we think those are the major ones. Do you think of anything else?
Women issues.
Conversion issues. What's going on? Tell me what you in this part of the world. What do you feel is going on? What's on the top of the agenda?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's dealing with I guess Jews. Well, it's not really a religious argument, but I guess dealing with Jews that are, anti-Jewish, anti-Israel,
right? Oh, yeah. I hear you. I don't know if it's contentious, but you know what I found.
Yeah,
I'm glad you raised that point. It gives me a chance to pontificate. It's just so. I'm not used to the polarization that exists, or maybe that's not even the right word. It's in so many cases, and even the examples I mentioned. There's such a dialogue of the deaf, as people have what they say, and they don't even listen to what you have to say. Okay. And I can tell you, I've been interviewed countless times by different media personalities, and they're never focused. I don't think I remember even one who was focused on what I was answering. Their focus always is what their next question is going to be. So when you stop talking, they'll ask the next question. But it's impossible to have a conversation that way, and you can't dialogue. And it's not even a question of changing minds. It's like, you take the Supreme Court decision the other day in Masterpiece Bake Shop.
Oh.
And so I read the decision because I wrote about it, and you see even in the majority decision and the concurrences and the dissent, they almost can't talk to each other. Alright, the world views or their interpretation of the facts, the precedents, or their personal wishes are just in so conflict, you can't even say this means that, and it's always meant that. So everyone is just writing. That's why so many concurrences. Everyone is just writing, and it's like they're not even convincing each other necessarily. Well, I'm sure there's some negotiations to come out with the majority decision as it was, but I think that's the most problematic thing. It just, you always find the same people saying the exact same things. It's almost. And, even a right-winger, I have a hard time watching. The news I'll watch, but the cable talk shows, I can't watch that much anymore. It's like a jukebox, all right? You put a coin in the jukebox, they still have those things. And
no.
You...
No.
Okay.
It's like
Chase the other night, yeah.
Right.
And you press a button, a song comes out. It's the same people every night. You give them, you put a coin in, you press a button, and they'll say the exact same thing. So that's why it's never resolved. Not to, I could add also, there are people who have a vested interest in never resolving anything, because that's the business they're in. They have an organization, they have an agenda, and that's what they do. They are almost intended to foment acrimony or a forceful articulation of their position regardless of what anyone else might convince them. So you can't convince them. It reminds me, in my reckless youth, I was a teenager, and I think it was in college and in law school at the time. So I lived for a couple of years in Manhattan, and sometimes if I'd be walking in Midtown, I'd see these missionaries. They still have missionaries around here,
yes.
Christian missionaries, but yeah. And I used to debate them, all right? I was like 19, 20 years old, yeah. And I would debate them, and then
Jews for Jesus one?
Jews for Jesus, yeah, and other Christian missionaries. And after a time, it was like talking to a lamppost, because they would spout things, and I would ask a question, and they'd spout the same thing again. I'd ask another question that undermined their argument, would just say the same thing again. What is the point? They don't want to learn. They just want to proselytize.
They're being consistent.
Right, but if they were intellectually honest, at least, they would be able to dialogue and say why this is right, this is wrong. You made your point, you didn't make your point. I mean, simple things like mistranslations of biblical verses. It's always a classic, all right? I'll say, well, that doesn't mean that. Mm. And it wouldn't even penetrate, because that's what they have and that's what it is. Would not penetrate. So I think those are the issues, but I think the frustrating thing today is that there can't be any progress on any of this because no one is really listening to what the other side is saying. Except for me.
Yeah.
Hey, why are you laughing?
Wait,
okay, yes.
You said you wrote an article about the decision?
I wrote about the decision, yeah.
RabbitPrzanski.com. Wow. Can you just, before we go read that later tonight, can you just give us a one or two sentence summary of what you came away with from that situation?
Right. Well,
I was following it, but
right. Okay. So
what a rabbi would say from that perspective.
Right. But the truth is, I had my lawyer hat on more than my rabbi hat when I did this. But what's that? Is that bad?
I don't know. Like, I want to know from like a Jewish perspective.
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. The decision itself, the majority decision, was crafted so that it took no ultimate position on the issue that was before the court. So it was as if the court felt that Phillips was wronged. He should have the right to refuse to honor his conscience, but we can't grant him that right on substantive grounds, so we'll grant him that right on almost procedural grounds that the Colorado Human Rights Commission was mean to him.
Yeah.
All right? That's not really a decision you want from the Supreme Court. But look, my position is, I think it was it's like a live and let live. If my presence will offend a merchant, I go to another merchant.
Mm-hmm.
A person should have the right to not do things that offend the conscience, whether it's in the issue of religion, morals, or even nationalism. A Jewish baker should have the right to say, I'm not baking a cake celebrating Hitler's birthday, all right, with swastikas on it. So live and let live. You know, it's not a service that you can't find elsewhere, but again, since there's no dialogue anymore, it's just an attempt to ram things down people's throats. But in terms of the rabbi hat, so this is the svar, this is the idea that I had, which if they would accept this, it would be a better country. No, it wouldn't, but nonetheless. There's a difference between the chefts and the gavra, meaning the object and the person. And you have that dichotomy in many halachic areas. Some Jewish laws apply to the person, and others to the object in question. So for example, if a person walks into a store, whatever person it is, and picks up an item off the shelf, the merchant has no right to say to him, you can't buy that because I don't like you. All right? You can't enter my restaurant because I don't want to serve you. Of course, there's no right to do that. That would be offensive. That's a law in the cheft, so the object. You should have the right to buy any object you want if a store is selling it. But to ask an individual to engage in service for you, to use his creativity and energy on your behalf, that's already enlisting the person, all right? And the person should have the right to say, I don't want to do that, okay? As a lawyer, I don't have to take every client, all right? So if a baker is offended by a particular individual, or not individual, by a particular cause, doesn't want to celebrate that cause, so therefore, whatever involves personal services, I would say a person should have the right to say, I can't do it. It'll violate my conscience. So I gave an example. What if someone walks into an ice cream store, all right, and says, I want a cone? And the merchant says, I don't serve ice cream to people like you, all right? Now, on one hand, it's really he's making the cone. It's not a fixed object. He's making it. But the difference is that, and this is what was a clarification, it's nothing that furthers or advances the cause that the merchant finds abhorrent, mm-hmm. all right? Whatever the cause might be. If the merchant selling a cone to someone does not. Decorating a cake with something that offends the conscience of the individual, and Jews can place in this situation also. I think a person has the right to say no, go elsewhere, all right? It's not as if you're denying emergency medical services to someone. You're denying someone a cake or flowers or a photographer. No one should be able to force someone into servitude against their will. I must have you as the photographer, but I have another job. No, I must have you. You can't say that. A person has the right to say no. And then once we respect everyone, then a lot of the tensions will go down. But again, like I said before, there's so many agendas and so many organizations that are devoted to the fight on both sides that unless they adopt this Gavra Cheftza mentality or formula, it's going to go on and on for years.
I like that answer.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. that I thought of. I actually thought of it on the Shabbaton. I think it was when we were eating. So
I hope the food was good.
So I'm vegetarian, but I eat fish. So.
Because fish eat vegetables also, so it's really mutual.
No, but it's interesting. So, you know, we have the fish course, right?
Right.
And the plate goes away because then the next course is meat. Right, so I think it was Friday night. There was meat and chicken, like together, right? Or at one point, there was meat and chicken on the same plate.
Okay.
Like steak and then chicken. And I thought to myself, well, a chicken is a bird, and the other one is like a mammal.
Right.
So how come those get to be on the same plate?
So why is chicken compared to meat,
but
fish is held apart?
Right, exactly.
Well,
like
both animals and fish, animals and fowl, live on the land. The fish are in their own domain.
That's what I thought.
But the real answer is that...
That's not the answer.
Fish and meat were perceived by the sages in ancient times to be dangerous to consume together.
Right.
And that's why... That was the medical science of the time.
And why? Okay. What was the science behind that?
You know something? I don't eat fish even now,
except for
gefilte and tuna.
Really?
But where in an age when there's no refrigeration, I don't think I would have had fish back then either, unless there's nothing else to eat. So there are many reasons why. So it wasn't a religious objection as much as it was a physiological one. It was perceived as unhealthy. So there are people don't always hold it anymore today, and some people are still very careful not to mix meat and fish. But you never had a problem mixing meat and fowl.
Right. So what was...
Because there was never a danger involved.
To not mix the meat.
The fish and meat were health related, correct.
Eating them at the same time.
Eating them together.
Really?
Yes. You could eat one after the other, but not together.
So you can eat one, and then like 2 minutes later eat the next.
Yes, that's correct. And that's why people are careful not to use the same dish, the same fork or knife for the same ride. If you wash it off, then it's all fine.
But there was never any danger between chicken and...
Correct. Chicken and meat, yeah.
Gail, just the Ram does not have that halacha in the Mishnah Torah, and the Maggid of Rome, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch says maybe it was not really an obligation. So how strict you have to be. So that's one question about that. But Herschel Schechter made a good point. People who are very careful that you shouldn't have the same fork, I get very neurotic, but really what was the whole purpose? For health.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, they're not careful about their eating. They're not exercising.
Right.
They're hitting the chomp pot three times.
Yep.
But no, we're not going to have that fish and that my fish and that. They're not touching.
And they're topping the meal for the cigarettes.
Right, that's it. Right, so meanwhile, the main point is it shows you that mentality that the chachamim, the rabbis, were so concerned about your well-being, they'd even make legislation to do things that they perceive as being medically harmful.
Yeah.
So we should extrapolate that, not just the limited second century prohibition of milk and meat and fish, but rather
those are the two, milk and meat, and then fish.
Well, milk and meat are not health related.
Right.
Milk and meat are religious related. But
chicken is meat when it comes to the dairy world too, and that was to protect us from.
Right, because they're used interchangeably. You know, people would mistake, since they're slaughtered the same way, basically. Exactly. So the original ban in the Torah did not include, it was meat and milk, but not chicken and milk. But it was extended because of the similarity. The Talmud says one of the Talmudic sages in his town, they ate chicken and milk together. They didn't hold by that decree.
Cheese turkey burger,
that's correct. That's correct. But already since Talmudic times, it was extended to chicken, turkey, for reasons that are understandable, because we do use them interchangeably. Yeah. Okay, another question. Yeah, come on. You know what you're supposed to say? You're supposed to say, I'll ask for someone else. Someone else has this question, and I'll just...
My friend wants to know.
Right. Correct. All right, anything else on your part?
I have one.
All right,
I either of you can remember. What's the proverb from Mishlei that has to do with not having to finish, like, clearing your plate? It's a food one.
You mean not finishing? I don't know if it's in Proverbs, but the Talmud has such a statement. If you clean off your plate, then it's a sign to the host or hostess that not enough food was served. All right? So you're supposed to leave a little over so that they should know that you're satiated from the meal. If you gobble up everything, then it means that you are not satisfied.
Not that it was tasty?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends how you spin it, all right? You could spin your voraciousness as just the delicious quality of the food, yeah.
And where exactly in the Talmud is that?
Ah, that's a good question. You know where it is?
I do not. Off the top.
Yeah. It's there.
I'd like to
see it. It's there. I'll find it. You know, if you have a Shulchan Aruch, I could probably find it here also.
Orchaim is on top.
It might be in Bez, but...
Orchaim what?
I think it's Bez. Let's see.
I'm going to quote that the next time I leave over my food. Oh, you want
to be exact. There's a chapter on proper etiquette during a meal.
Oh, really? Where is that?
Right here.
Let's see,
Kuf Ayin, 170.
170 in Orchaim.
Let's see.
Where is there in the...
Can't talk.
They had a little star there, too, to save it. They had that new feature on Safari and now to save a favorite.
Let's see. I'll just pause 1 second. All right, so this is interesting. If you have a cup of something, you shouldn't down it in one gulp. You're considered a gargaron, a glutton. You should use two sips derech eretz, proper. Three, ready like a fancy east cider, they would say. Okay. Send me an email, and I'll let you know exactly where it is.
Amos Tachlin, Mishnah Ochel, Velod Beman, also Shlomo Aisha. What's that? Amos Tachlin. Shikoach, he came in and. Monthly guest lecture, I think.
I want to thank everyone here also, because I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Absolutely.
But even to come in and to see your enthusiasm and your questions, and you know, it's after a long work day also, to me it's very impressive. So I hope to do it again, and I thank you all.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Okay. Oh, go on. You want to say something?
Yes. It was beautiful. So, all right. So we'll.
Thank you.